Mojave Beach Productions.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana bring you stories of faith and inspiration, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana present Dear Dean, Love, Mom, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International and narrated by Esther Luttrell.
Episode 2.
The notion was comforting, but I was still tormented by grief. The hole where he'd been in my life was enormous. I danced around it in agony. Brooke, who lived in New Jersey, had to return home. 2 weeks after his death, Brooke invited me to visit her in her little cottage near a stand of woods. She was still struggling with our loss, and I suspected that my being there might give us both some solace. Being April, tiny flowers were poking their heads out of the ground all around her house, and we talked about how Dean would have loved her place. He liked the woods. He loved plants. She'd planned on asking him to recuperate at her house when he felt like traveling. I tried to function. Tried for her sake to smile, but nights in the guest bed, I cried myself to sleep. One night was especially difficult. The tears wouldn't stop, and the pain was as close to unbearable as anyone could imagine. And I gasped out loud, "Oh, darling, if only I knew where you were. My whole concept of heaven's been blown out of the water. You can't carry a tune, so I know you aren't up there singing the Hallelujah Chorus. And you darn well aren't flapping around strumming a harp. Where are you? Where?" Moonlight filtered across the room through lace curtains at the windows. I was aware of how pretty Brooke had made the place, aware of the moonlight, aware of everything. Yet I lay there tormented by the feeling of not knowing. If only I could envision where he was. Was he as dust in the ground? Was he no more than the ashes we sprinkled from a friend's plane over the beach Dean loved so much? Was that all of him? At the zenith of such pain, when I didn't see how I could live through it, I felt a rush of air on my face that made me literally gasp for breath. The wind stung my eyes, so I closed them. And when I did, I had the sensation of flying. I could actually see landscape beneath me. I was flying faster than a bird, faster than a plane. Maybe not so fast as a speeding bullet, but I sure was sailing over lovely terrain. Just scarcely clearing treetops, I raced along, stretched out with my arms in front of me like Superman. In an instant, I cleared the trees, and then I was zooming over hills, and then the desert, and then, amazing, I was in space. There was nothing around me but silence. I was still going fast, but with nothing to gauge speed against, I don't know if I was going as fast as I'd been going. What I do know is that wind ceased raking my hair back from my face and I could breathe naturally again. When I came to a stop, I was on the most incredible surface. It looked like a moonscape. I remember clearly that a huge boulder was to my left, and it rose maybe 20, 30 feet from the ground, and it was covered in rock. As far as I could see, all the way to the horizon, there was nothing but flat, broken rocks. The sky was filled with darkness, vast darkness. Not frightening darkness, but a caressing darkness, velvety. Like the moon rising over desert landscape, a beautiful blue planet was emerging. Only about one half, the top half, was visible. Everything around me was covered in a magnificent silver-blue sheen. I realized that Dean was standing to my right, but a bit behind me so that he was out of my sight. And I said out loud, "Oh, honey, this is incredible. But where in the world are we?" A nagging little thought crept into my mind. Dear God, don't tell me this is where he lives, here all by himself. It was beautiful, but it was desolate. There was no sound and no movement, just tranquility and absolute silence. Dean said in that deep, wonderful voice I love so much, "This is where I come when I want to be alone and think." I nodded toward the moon rising on the horizon. "What's that?" His voice had a hint of humor in it. "That's Earth, Mom." That's when my eyes flew open. My heart was hammering. I hadn't been asleep. I'd been talking to Dean and crying when the whole thing started. I'd felt the wind in my face. I heard his voice. I had been there with him. I squeezed my eyes shut and I hung on to my sanity as best I could. "Oh, darling," I whispered into the moonlit room. "Thank you, thank you." At that moment, I felt a distinct kiss on my right cheek. It was soft, yet firm, and slightly damp. It lasted only a moment, and then it was gone. Dean was gone. I'd been with him. He was all right. And I darn well didn't dream it. On the plane, going back to California, I thought back to something that had happened just the Christmas before at my mother-in-law's home. Dean had never visited his stepdad, Larry's, mom before. Reva was pushing 90, but she could flat wear me out. She would best be described as a realistic, conservative dynamo. She still worked every day as executive secretary for her church, still drove her car, still handled all of the church investments, or at least prepared them for their CPA to handle, still cooked for family and friends on holidays, and still ruled her roost with a will of iron. Well, Dean knew her from her few trips to see us in Seal Beach, but this year we were going to rendezvous at her place in Miami. Larry and I settled into the largest of her 5 bedrooms on the 2nd floor. Dean chose a smaller one next to ours. That first night we turned in pretty early, tired from our journey and from hours of visiting with those dropping by to see Reva's kids, who worked at a big Hollywood studio. Our first morning there, Larry did what he always did whenever we were at Reva's house or she at ours. He got up at dawn to have coffee and read out loud with her Science and Health with Key to the Scripture by Mary Baker Eddy. It was a ritual that began when he was a child and never varied when they were together. Well, somewhere around 7 or so, there was a soft tap at the bedroom door, and I called out, "It's unlocked," and Dean stuck his head into the room. "Morning," I said, patting a spot next to me on the side of the bed. Dean sat down, looking unusually grave. "What's the matter?" I asked. He shook his head slowly. "I don't know how to say it." "What's wrong?" "Oh, it isn't really wrong. It's..." "Well, okay. Here's what happened." He took a second to collect his thoughts. "I was getting ready to get under the covers last night when it felt like somebody was watching me. You know that feeling. But the Venetian blinds were shut and so was my door, so I knew there was nobody around. I turned off the light and I got in bed, and that's when I saw a little boy, maybe 7 or 8 years old, at the foot of the bed." "What?" I think I squeaked a little bit. "He was just standing there staring at me. It struck me that he looked so solemn. Like the loneliest kid in the world." "What are you saying? You saw a ghost?" Dean shook his head. "Well, he looked solid enough, but yeah, it had to be." "Were you afraid?" "No, I was worried about him. He looked so unhappy." "What'd you do?" "Finally, I said hello to him." "Well, what'd he do?" "He said, 'Can you play catch with me?'" I told him it was dark outside and that I needed to go to sleep, that I couldn't play with him. He just kept staring at me with those huge, sad eyes. I asked him if he had a name. He sort of whispered, "John." I asked him how old he was, but I'm not sure I heard him right. I think he said 9, but he was awfully small for 9. Anyway, he asked me again if I could play catch with him, and I said again that it was late and that we couldn't play. Well, then what happened? He disappeared. I lay back on my pillow. Huh, for heaven's sake. Dean said, what do you make of it? I don't know, honey. I reached for his hand, and we looked at each other, trying to puzzle out what, of course, couldn't be puzzled out. A few minutes later, Dean and I joined Reva and Larry in the kitchen. Dean sat at the table across from my husband while my mother-in-law hustled around preparing pancakes and I don't remember what else. I was pouring myself a cup of coffee at the counter when I said, do you think a child named John ever lived in this house, Reva? She whipped around to me, her mouth set in a straight, disapproving line and a scowl on her face. Well, I could see that she was offended or angry, but I couldn't imagine what triggered such a reaction. I glanced at Larry, who was subtly shaking his head, a signal to shut up and sit down, which I did. Not another word was said about it. We ate our breakfast in somber silence. When I was alone with Larry, I asked him what happened. He was reluctant to answer, though he finally did. I had a brother. He died before I was born. His name was John. Mom's never talked about him. No one else is even allowed to mention him. I didn't even know about him until a few years ago. That was complete news to me. Oh, that poor, poor child, I kept thinking. Little John was still waiting to be acknowledged, still waiting for somebody to show they cared, and my heart just broke for him. When I shared the story with Dean, he said he wished he'd encouraged the kid to stay and talk. He hoped John would reappear during the course of our 3-day stay, but he never did. How did that prepare me for what would happen a year later when Dean came back to take me to the place where he could be alone and think? I'm not sure. But it seems possible the incident at Reva's house set the foundation for Dean and for me to be comfortable with the idea of life after death. I don't think we'd ever talked about it before, but we each accepted the sad little boy whom Dean met in the guest room as real. Maybe that's why it was easy for Dean to reach me a year later from the other side, because we had both opened our mind and our heart to the reality of spirit eternal. The days stretched out in front of me. They came and they went, one at an agonizing time. I breathed in and I breathed out. I walked forward and I stepped to the side. I lay down, I got up, I ate, I slept, some. Life had no color, no purpose. The gaping hole of loneliness and pain roared for me to leap inside and pull the ground in over me. Dean. Gone. Forget the silent midnight planet where he went to be alone. Forget the damp, reassuring kiss on my cheek in Brooke's guest room. He was gone, and life would never be the same. Life would never be, period. I still knew that God was with me. I still knew that Dean was fine, but I was not. When Dean's insurance company informed me that I was the beneficiary of a small inheritance, I buckled. I don't want his insurance money, I wanted to scream. I want him. I collapsed into the rocking chair in my office and sobbed until I wrung myself dry. Then I again noticed the box of Dean's writing under my desk. In that instant, I felt I heard him say, "That's it, Mom. Go out and help aspiring screenwriters." Help them how? I said the words aloud, thinking that a drawer filled with rejection slips wouldn't be of a lot of value to many folks. But the voice, not his, but my own voice, yet from Dean, continued. Tell them what you learned at MGM. You pitched stories and you were pitched too. You saw how deals were made, how it's done from the inside. Tell them how it really is, Mom. I sat there thinking about it for a few minutes. Then I got up and went to the phone where I dialed the number of my ex-boss, a producer on the TV series Chips when I was production coordinator. Don Gold had gone on to produce Miami Vice for 7 years, and was now producer of the popular Dick Van Dyke series, Diagnosis Murder. When Donald answered, I said without preamble, I know what I'm going to do with Dean's insurance money. I'm going to go cross-country helping aspiring screenwriters. I'm going to do for them what I wish I'd done for him. Want to go? He didn't miss a beat. Sure, when do we start? With the blessing of his wife, Joella, and my husband, Larry, we took our first leap into the world of screenwriting workshops in October of 1994. I decided that we would have our little out-of-town tryout in Kansas City, Missouri. If all went well, we wouldn't make too big of fools of ourselves, and we might actually be of some assistance to somebody along the way. What I'd forgotten in the rush to honor Dean's memory was that I'm terrified of speaking in front of crowds, even tiny crowds. When I'd go to some function where we sat in a circle and the ringmaster or whomever was conducting whatever it was I was attending, ask us to introduce ourselves and tell a little bit about what we did, my mouth would go cotton ball dry. My palms would sweat. My heart thundered. Worst of all, my chest would become so constricted that when I spoke, I sounded like Minnie Mouse on helium. Nevertheless, I'd made a commitment. I'd go wherever I could help make somebody's writing dream come true. Later, after I'd written a screenwriting textbook and workshop students asked me to sign it, I dropped the word dream and wrote on the flyleaf, "May all your goals come true." I came to realize that a goal is a dream put to action. As I told one young lady who questioned me on it, I'm not much interested in taking my time to work with somebody who wants to sit under a tree and dream about becoming a screenwriter. But I'll bust my buns to help anyone who makes that their goal and who's willing to work for it. I made arrangements to rent a mansion near the University of Missouri for the weekend. Then I hired a catering service to bring in individual picnic baskets filled with healthful sandwiches and fruit. Nothing plastic or artificial was allowed. The lunches, served by two women venturing into their own catering business, were outstanding. The baskets a hit. I felt that if Donald and I were there to nurture creativity, our setting had to be as creative as we could make it. No hotel banquet rooms for us. Nothing sterile or mundane would be tolerated. That first workshop was like trying out for Olympic gold. How was I ever going to get my mouth open and my voice working? My stomach lurched. As our first students took their seats, my heart nearly thumped its way out of my bosom. I excused myself and ran to the restroom, where I dashed into a stall. I leaned against the closed door, pulling in deep, calming breaths. God, I whispered aloud, let me get out of my way. Let me forget about me and remember that I'm here to honor Dean and to help whoever needs our help. Let your words come out of my mouth. Let me say whatever it is you would have me say. Thank you. Amen. I walked out of that restroom with quiet confidence. I marched myself to the front of the room, took in a lung full of air, and I began. Hi. I'm Esther. I understand you want to be a screenwriter, and I have to tell you, that's probably the worst idea you've ever had. But if you're determined, then let us at least educate you to the reality of Hollywood. But be warned, you're in for one heck of a bumpy ride. Well, Donald and I were off and running. Kansas City, where Dean was born, was the first stop in what would amount to 10 years of producing workshops across the country. When we left for California the next day, I sat beside Don on the plane and leaned my head against the cool glass window. There was a huge lump in my throat as I whispered silently, "Did I do it, honey? Is that what you wanted?" I swear to you, I heard him say inside my head, "That was it, Mom. You did good." What followed that first undertaking was so unexpected that I completely misunderstood the purpose behind it all. I thought I was meeting people I was supposed to help write screenplays, but they were coming to me in such strange ways that I was confused. And there were so many of them that I panicked. I could tutor them to the point where they had a perfectly formatted, dynamically told screenplay, but I didn't have the magic that would get it made into a movie. Yet on they came, a stream of students from everywhere, some of them riding cross-country in a bus because a bus was all they could afford. They were following their heart, expecting Donald or me to catapult them straight to writer's paradise or at least onto a studio lot. But screenwriting isn't just an art, it's also a craft. Some of it can be learned, and some of it can't. You either have a cinematic sense of dialogue and scenes, or you don't. You can be taught to format. You can be taught to hone your talent. You can be taught marketing techniques. But if you don't have an ear for the way people talk, if you don't see each scene on a mental screen as you write it, then no teacher can help you. There are actors, producers, directors, all kinds of professionals who've been in the film business most of their adult life and still can't get a particular picture made. It took Michael Douglas years to get the classic award-winning One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest produced, and that was after his father Kirk finally gave up trying to do it. It took Barbara Streisand years to put Yentl together, and the same is true of Lily Zanuck's Driving Miss Daisy, even though it had already been a Pulitzer Prize-winning play. Executive producer Anne-Marie Gellin spent 4 years trying to put Fried Green Tomatoes together, and that was 3 years after others had made every effort to produce it. It was difficult to make those attending our workshops and seminars understand that before their first script to be sent to Hollywood or Burbank or wherever they were sending it, they had to first comprehend the business of being a screenwriter. Yet I was determined. I would teach and preach until I was all taught out, if need be. When I came home after one of our weekend outings, I'd see that box of Dean's story ideas under my desk, and a wave of resolve would sweep over me. I'd push up my sleeves and begin planning the next workshop somewhere around the country. By heaven, I would do for others what I wish I had done for Dean. It had been said lightly to Donald. It was said in earnest to God. I chose the cities in which we gave our event, well, for mostly personal reasons. For instance, I'd gone to junior high and half year of high school in Texas, so I wanted to give a workshop there just to kind of see how it looked all these years later. Burbank Junior High in Houston, it was one of my best experiences. Well, I had visions of connecting with kids I'd never forgotten from those early years, Johnny Baird, the handsome North Houston movie theater usher, and Barbara Botts and Ray Floyd, Laverne Corliss. I could envision reunions and big hugs and the sharing of memories. But for some reason, I wasn't able to connect with a film commissioner there. I'd planned to make it a point to always contact the local film commissioner's office before coming to their territory. I'd already decided on a policy of inviting them to speak, or at least be on hand to answer questions from students. Well, I didn't feel the Houston office was intentionally avoiding me, but it was frustrating not to be able to make contact with anyone there. I realized that when I attempt something and I meet only brick walls, that maybe God's telling me to do something else. It isn't always easy to determine when you're supposed to square your shoulders and push on, proving you've got grit and spunk, or when it's time to simply move along to Plan B. After a while, I gave up trying to put a Houston workshop together and decided to set my sights on Austin instead. The fact I chose Austin because I couldn't make it happen in Houston should have been my first clue that something cosmic was up. I thought I selected Austin because I'd never been there and it would be an interesting experience. The truth is, Austin had chosen me. I always say to God when I have a problem and I ask for his direction, hey, God, don't be subtle. You gotta burn a bush or I won't get it. Well, no bush burned, and I didn't get it. Not right then, anyway.
You've been listening to Dear Dean, Love, Mom, told by its author Esther Luttrell, and brought to you by The Voice of Helona in association with Mojave Beach Productions. The Voice of Helona theme was composed and performed by David Randa of Fesleyan Studios. Patrick McGranahan produced. This production was recorded by Dean Fairweather. Funding for Dear Dean, Love, Mom was made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the support of all aspects of forgiveness in families, communities, businesses, and personal relationships. Visit their website at forgivenessfoundationinternational.com. This is Jeff Evans, inviting you to soar on the wings of imagination to Mojave Beach Productions' world of audio entertainment.
Mojave Beach Productions.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for soaring with us on the wings of imagination as you listen to stories we're having so much fun creating for you. If you enjoy what you hear, take a moment to subscribe to Mojave Beach Productions on your favorite podcast app. And thanks a million.